I hope you enjoyed our conversation with John Burden in our last session. He's been a friend of mine for several years now, and I just appreciate the way he thinks through culture issues as he goes about his business of leading a large and growing church. And so today I wanted to do a follow-up on his conversation, but just some reminders about what we're talking about with culture. Culture is found in, you'll note the three circles there, espoused values. In other words, what do they say they believe? What do they, a culture, a group of people, the way we do things here, what do they believe is important? Then basic assumptions on the bottom, underlying, often unconscious assumptions. An unconscious assumption is, you know, as we talked before about the company that had all these men who were 5'9" and shorter. It was an assumed thing that went into who they were, defining who they were as a group of people. So are they thought processes and actions and that sort of thing? And then the artifacts or anything that's made as a result of that particular culture. Products, technology, style, clothing. Again, this model that I have up here is from the business world. And so, you know, but what are the myths, the stories, the rituals? I want to take this session just to dig a little bit deeper into that idea of generational culture, because in our world today, with all the technology, the changes in generations are becoming far more dramatic than they have been previously. And so I just want to spend some time talking about the millennials, the generation right now. In my country, I have a deep, abiding burden for the millennial generation because they are becoming unchurched. All the studies that have been done in the United States show that that generation is leaving church in unprecedented numbers. And before, we used to figure, like with the baby boomer generation, those born after World War II, that they would come back to church once they started families. But that's not happening with the millennial generation. So I want to look a little more deeply, keeping in mind some of the things that John said about his church and his experience and how he works with the millennial generation. So who are the millennials? What is that culture like? Here in the United States, again, you're going to have to translate that into your culture if you are elsewhere. In the United States, millennials in general, this is a generalization, so it's not true in every case, but in general, they have a sense of entitlement. In other words, things that their parents and their grandparents had to work hard for are now handed to them, are given to them. I just spent a week with my family, my son and his five children and his wife, and I see this younger generation, not my son so much, he's in the baby buster generation, but my grandchildren are given things. They're given computer access. They are given new sporting outfits. They are assumed that they can pay for registration in Little League to play baseball or in soccer or in football. There's just a lot of assumption. At Christmas, they get not just little gifts, but they get tablets that they can use in their own gaming time. They watch TV on a large screen. There's a sense of entitlement, things that previous generations could only think about, maybe dream about, but not afford. They just feel like it comes with the territory because for them, all their life it has. They have a lack of delayed gratification. Delayed gratification is something like, in my case, when I decided that I wanted to drive, I had to save up money for a car. And so I began saving. I was working at that time as a busboy in a restaurant, and I saved money. I saved my salary. I saved my tips. I tried to save every dime I possibly could because I had this goal of purchasing a car, and I knew I could not purchase that car until I had money saved up, because in my family there wasn't anything like paying cash or paying on credit for anything. But nowadays it's assumed that we pay on credit and then we pay back ourselves, hopefully, rather than just keep the credit out there. But the millennial generation has a lack of delayed gratification. If they want something, they get it now. They don't put it off until they can afford it or until they have the cash ready to purchase it outright. Now, all of these things I'm saying here sound negative, and I don't necessarily mean that to be true. I just want to give a generalization that they're used to getting what they want now. individualism and isolation. It's a fascinating thing. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, recently appeared before Congress, and he shared the mission of Facebook. You know, what he wants a mission to be. We're going to be talking about mission and value statements in the next part of this class. But he shared that his mission was to connect people around the world. It's a beautiful mission, and yet it's connected, and yet the connections are really, really tenuous at best. You know, what do you show somebody on Facebook? You show only your best side. You don't live life with each other. And in fact, you can communicate with each other by never speaking to each other. And so as a result, those who are studying the millennial generation are saying they are disconnected. They're isolated from one another. They are individualistic in their thinking because they don't come together in groups very quickly or very easily. They are a postponed generation. Now, when I got married, I was 22 years old, and that was fairly common. The common time of getting married was somewhere between 20 and 21. Well, now, the first job that a person holds who's in the millennial generation, first full-time job, is generally speaking around 25, 26 years old. And they don't get married now until about 29 on average. And so it's this delayed kind of reaction. A fast-paced, unfocused. They live life fast, rapid. They're going all the time. And as a result, they have a hard time sitting down and focusing on one task. And I even find that. I'm a baby boomer. And yet I find after working for so many years, now that I'm retired, I thought I'd be able to sit back and read, but I kind of have trouble focusing for a long time on a book, whereas I used to read these large tomes and just enjoy sitting there for hours reading. I find that I've become unfocused. Well, that's the way this generation grew up, with all of this activity, all of this input, kind of a chaotic life of multiple inputs and sounds coming at them all the time. Undecided and indecisive. In other words, they have difficulty making big decisions, and they don't like to make big decisions, and so they try to blur that. Put that off. Blurred sex roles. In America now, United States, it's law that men can marry a woman, a man can marry a woman, or a man can marry a man, or a woman. There's kind of this tolerance of all sex roles, and so there's nothing clear there for them. And they're comfortable with contradiction. They may sense this idea of not having absolute truth. You know, they no longer believe that absolute truth is absolutely true. And so what they'll do is create this contradiction that they're comfortable with. John Stott, great English theologian, once told a story about walking in the park, and he ended up encountering two very young men, and he began talking with them. And as was his practice, he presented the gospel to them. Said that he was somebody who'd come to know about Jesus Christ. And so he told them about the creation of the world by a God who created it beautiful and good, and how it fell into sin, as recorded in Genesis chapter 3, and how Adam and Eve made that choice to disobey God. And as a result, all the creation is twisted by sin. But God still wanted to have a relationship with us, but that sin that had to be paid for, that each of us now deals with in our bent nature towards sin. And so Jesus Christ came as the Son of God in the flesh to die for our sins. And now he offers us eternal life if we'll just believe in him, the resurrected, reigning Lord, if we'll accept him into our lives. And then he says, so what do you think? And they looked at each other and said, it sounds like it's true. And so he said, well, would you like to pray and receive this Jesus into your life? And the response is, no, we don't think that'll work for us. That kind of contradiction. They can say it's true, but it's not going to work for us, so we'll just ignore it. That's this generation. It's a very confused generation. Now, on the other hand, it's a very spiritual generation, even though we find that their church going is less than ideal. The builder generation, those born before World War II. In our country, about 51% attend church regularly. The boomer generation, my generation, attend 38% attend church regularly. The busters, my children, 28% attend church regularly. Millennials, somewhere around 17%, although it's hard to get those numbers down because these studies tend to be flawed, especially with younger people who answer questions the way that they think you want them to be answered. So you see, there's a big need there, and yet there's a spirituality that is vibrant in that group. They rejected church in a way, but they've not rejected God. I had the privilege of being in a concert just 2 weeks ago, and it was a concert of a well-known musical group, the Irish singing group Rend Collective, a Christian musical group. And I was shocked because I figured I must have been one of the oldest people there. It was a younger gathering. But these people, these young adults, were excited. They were engaged in the singing. They were celebrating the goodness and the greatness of God. And they were doing it with their bodies and they were doing it with their mouths as they sang along with songs. They are engaged. They are engaged spiritually, not disconnected spiritually. It's just that church doesn't seem to fit them anymore. Why not? Well, if you're going to reach a millennial, you've got to keep this in mind. These are the kind of things that you should look for in the United States. These are their criticisms of the church as it exists right now in the United States. First of all, shallow worship. In other words, they are not comfortable with just coming in, sitting in a pew, singing a couple of songs, hearing somebody speak at them from the pulpit, and then leaving again. They say it's shallow, they say the preaching is confusing, they say it's not very deep, and instead what they would like to have is engaged worship, where they engage with each other in worship, or where they engage with the message in a different way, where they have interactive kind of experiences in worship. One church that is reaching millennials well in our country does it by creating stations in worship, and they have a section in their worship time where they just go to a station, and at this station they maybe will paint a painting, or they'll write a poem, they'll do something creative in response to what they've been hearing as far as the Bible being explained that day. At another station, they may have a discussion with a few other people about some key points of what was brought up in the message that day. At another station, they might make something that they take home as a reminder of the message that they can put on their refrigerator or hang from their car mirror or whatever. They want to be engaged in worship. They say nobody listens to them. Say when they talk, nobody cares what they say, and in fact, they don't see a great deal of people like them involved in the worship service. And so if you're going to be involved in leading millennials or engaging millennials in your church, they have to be heard, you have to be listened to, and they have to be empowered to be part of the worship experience. The staff in the church I just completed my service in, we studied as a staff how we do this, because we realized that we've got to improve in this area. One of our vision statements parts say that we exist to reach the next generation. And so we began talking about that and realized that we've got to have these people in worship. And so our worship director just took that and ran with it. And so every week there are teenagers who are up in front singing and playing instruments. There are teenagers who are in the back of the church who are running the sound and the visuals for that day. There are teenagers who are teaching in our education department as our director of family ministries has caught on to this and is engaging them so they feel part of it. They feel like they're heard. They feel like they belong. Another criticism, they say helping the poor is not a priority. They see the church is taking in resources and just using it to keep on doing it. And you know, there's that old statement about the well, where somebody came and saw this oil well and the owner happened to be there and began talking with him and say, well, how much do you produce? And he says, well, we produce enough to keep the well going. And that's the way they look at the church. We just produce enough to keep the church going. And they have a sense of the heart of Jesus for the poor. They don't see the church engaging by trying to solve the problems of the poor. And so that's a criticism. If you're going to plan a ministry for millennials, you've got to keep that in mind. They distrust the use of resources. In other words, they see money being given to the church, but they've had so many examples of church leaders who have abused that opportunity that they distrust things that are given to the local church, and they'll seek other ministries to give their money to. They have a longing to be mentored. In other words, they want to have somebody come alongside them because their life is so confusing in general that they want somebody to help them walk through the way, but they don't know how to go about that. And so the ministry that reaches millennials is going to have to provide some mentoring. A need to be valued. That's very close to what I was saying with somebody listening. And no place for outsiders. They see the church as pretty closed. It hasn't been open to people coming in who are like them. As I was preparing this lecture, I thought of the first church I served where we actually had a pew fall apart and it fell on the back of a woman and she sued the church as a result. And so we had to work through that process of a lawsuit. And one of the things we had to do was look at our pews and realize they were old and they were crotchety. And so we decided to get new pews. And so we did this campaign in this little tiny church. It was only about 100 people. And we said, you know, let's each family that can, let's donate a pew, right? And so they did, and we were in a short time able to purchase new pews that increased our seating, so we were able to grow a little bit more in our worship attendance, and it also created some problems, you see, because we had a couple of families who purchased pews, and they thought they purchased the pew that they were sitting in, and so they would come in, visitors would come in and would like to sit in the back, as they often would come in and try to get out. They really don't want to engage a great deal the first time. And yet, this family would come in later and say, I'm sorry, you're sitting in my place. You're in my pew. And so they don't see a church as being open to outsiders. So, what kind of church do you build? If you're going to reach millennials, if you're looking at engaging that culture, that the way we do things here, well, one of the things you have to do is be kingdom-minded. In other words, what are the things that Jesus was really concerned about? You find that he wasn't concerned about political power a great deal. He says very little about that, does Jesus. We've got a couple of statements in the writings of Paul, how we are to pray for leaders, even kings, and etc. But Jesus only has this one encounter where they try to trick him by saying, with a coin, you know, do we pay taxes to Caesar or not? He says, give me a coin. Whose image is on it? It's Caesar's. Well, then he says, give to Caesar what's Caesar's and to God's what is God's. We in the United States became obsessed to get political power over the years, and the millennials reject that entirely. Things like organizations that used to exist, like the evangelical organizations, like the Moral Majority, etc. They don't want any part of getting political power. They want to make a difference in the world. They want to make a difference in people's lives. They want it tangible. In fact, there are some old statements about, you know, why people will give to various causes. Well, the builder generation will give just because they're faithful in giving. And so my mother-in-law is 92 years old, is a builder, and she shops at the same store, she buys gas at the same gas station, and she gives money to her church, and she gives money to the denomination, and she'd go without food if it meant she couldn't give regularly to her church or denomination. Whereas my generation said, we want bang for the buck. We're not just going to give money. We want to see that it's doing something. And the next generation, the busters and then the millennials, more want to see that they are engaged in the solutions. They don't want to just give the money away. They want to see things that they can become involved in. In the church I just finished serving, one of the big things we did was ministry to Honduras. And these college kids would work, delayed gratification, but would work throughout the year, would save throughout the year so that they could take a trip to Honduras in June and make a difference there among orphans and among people who were, didn't have clean water to drink, didn't have the basics of life, like a latrine that was safe. So they want to make a difference. It's got to be communal. They talk about relationships being a priority, and they're a very related group of people. They are concerned about justice, and so they're going to stand for justice, and they have a nose for authenticity. Like if you're just playing a role or playing a game of some sort, they don't want any part of it whatsoever. And so how do you build a church like that? Well, the question is, who are you trying to reach? I've given you just a couple of examples. I've tried to create a picture of American culture, but then within that American culture, a generational slice of the culture, to try to give you an idea of how to go about this idea of thinking culturally. Who are you trying to reach? What is their culture like? What strategies might work in reaching them? Now, one example. I have a daughter who is in a church in St. Louis, Missouri. When she went there, she was going to Washington University. That's why she and her now husband moved from Michigan, where My daughter moved from California, son-in-law from Michigan, moved there in order to get an education at Washington University. They became part of a church, and that church had a college-age group within the church, within the congregation. And so they joined that college-age group, met in a bar on Sunday nights. It was a rather interesting experience. I got to worship with them a few times. But that group of people decided that it was important to reach their generation for Jesus Christ. And so they decided to start a church. They looked around the neighborhoods and said, now where would we feel called by God to reach people who are our age, who are in our generation? And they targeted an area that was being gentrified. It was Lafayette Square, Lafayette Park area. And they ended up starting all of these single people. And they met for over a year trying to learn the culture. They moved into that community. And then for a year, they just met people. And they devised a church. First of all, the church was engaged in service. They didn't do worship for the first year and a half that they existed. But everybody in the church had a volunteer position in the community. In fact, my daughter met people because she volunteered at working with animals. And there was an animal park nearby. She volunteered to clean it up. They had a dog, and she'd bring the dog, and she'd meet people there. But it was this idea of service. How are we serving the community? And through that service, to engage people who would hopefully see the service heart of the church and become engaged in it. When they began worship, they defined worship very carefully to fit the culture. They found that the area where they were living was made up of young adults, of course, millennials. But a lot of them were kind of artsy in their lifestyle. They were artists and musicians, as well as artists who paint and artists who write. And so they researched what would reach this group of people. They did surveys, door-to-door surveys. What would you like to see in a worship service? And they found that they were going to sing hymns rather than newer worship songs, because the story of the hymns was very important. So, of course, they do it in an upbeat way. But that was a big decision for them. And then they said, you know, we can't just come and sit in our chairs at the beginning, and we've got to have interaction, that communal interaction. And so in their worship service, they have set aside time that is part of their worship, but they just stop. You know, they've been singing some songs, they do some prayer together, and then they stop, and they all go and get a cup of coffee, and they get a donut, or they get a piece of fruit, and they all sit and chat for a while to deepen community. And then, in addition to that, everybody who's a member of that church becomes part of a life group, it's called. In other words, people with whom you do life, and they meet weekly on Sunday evenings. And so it's got this community aspect to it as well. And so each of those life groups adopts ministries various places in that idea of kingdom building. Now, this group started, of course, they started all a single. Now they're old enough that they all have children, that original group. But the church has grown. Just a year and a half ago, they were able to purchase a building, which is right in Lafayette Square. It used to be a Baptist church many years ago. The building on the left is a picture of a school that they recognized that it was important to provide some education in that area, so they created a charter school that is not officially a ministry of the church, but the church members serve on the board of that school, because the schools in St. Louis have a bad reputation. So they thought, here, we can minister to this culture, we can touch this culture with education. They took that building, they rehabbed it, they've made it a beautiful place. It was derelict for many, many years. And now I got to visit there with them a few weeks ago. And now you see not just that original group of 30 or 40 people who started this church, but now there's a couple of hundred people attending. And it's downright interesting to go in there, because I was by far the oldest person there. Now, they complain about that. They recognize the need now to become intergenerational, because there's nobody who's helping take care of their kids. And so they've been reaching out to other churches, seeking to get some older couples to come in and help with the outreach. But anyway, that's one example of a church that looks at the culture and says, how do we reach this culture positively? How do we reach it effectively? And they've done a wonderful job of it. And so in the next session, we're going to talk about how do you look at your culture? How do you define in your ministry or ministry you're working with or organization that you're a part of? How do you go about figuring out what is this culture that we're part of? And then how do you figure out how do we mold this culture that we're part of as leadership involves change, changing culture to a preferred future? So we'll talk to you next time.